A big welcome to 2016, and this is your racing life. We're our very good sponsors in Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lights, have been marvellous to be with us here on 1116 SEN. And we're starting off the new year with one of the greats of racing. Just before Christmas, we spoke with Gary Willetts about that marvellous combination of Gary and the great Manicato. They had 25 wins together. But what about this guy here this morning? Greg Charles and Sunline. Greg had 33 rides for 22 wins, 11 at Group 1 level. But not only Sunline was in his life, there was another great called Northerly. 6 rides, 6 wins, including the Caulfield Cup and the Australian Cup. A New Zealand champion, Greg Charles, good morning to you.
Morning, Brian.
Thanks for popping in. How was Christmas?
Yeah, Christmas is terrific. It's been busy. We went to New Zealand in middle of December to catch up with all the family and friends and came back for Christmas Day, and it's been very pleasing.
And you've put in New Year's okay?
Yeah, that's right. No New Year's resolution, but hopefully we can enjoy the new year and the year ahead.
Yeah, that's good to hear. And your family, of course, there are two. You have a daughter and a son, and the son's following in Dad's footsteps, and he's making nice sort of inroads too, Jordan Charles.
Yes, he has, is Brian. He's in his last year of apprenticeship with Patrick Payne, and he's chalked up a number of wins. Couldn't tell you offhand how many in total, but it's over 100, about 130 or 140 wins, and he's progressing really well.
Well, I can tell you about your riding career, but you know better than I do, but you rode for just on 30 years. I think your first ride about 1978 and retired in December of 2008.
That's right, Brian. I think it was around 31 years I was race riding for, all up, and I had a terrific career, rode many countries around the world and rode a couple of champions along the way.
Did you ever? 72 Group 1 wins in that career with wins, as you say, all around the world, close to 2,100. So there's nothing you didn't achieve, including 2 Caulfield Cups and 2 Cox Plates. And whenever we think of Greg Charles, we think of one horse in particular in that Sunline. Do you find you would have found it sort of in the latter part of your career when she came into your life in the last 8 to 9 years? Do you find that whenever people bump into you, they want to talk about Sunline or Northerly? Which one?
Yeah, Sunline. And often the question is asked, or they comment that they thought Northerly was a better horse than Sunline. What are my thoughts? And my response to that is, well, Sunline, I feel, was the better horse because Sunline not only she came from New Zealand, she had to travel to Australia. She also raced and won in Hong Kong. She travelled to Dubai. She raced left-handed, right-handed. Whenever she was accepted in a race, she was never scratched. She was just so versatile and so brilliant. Where Northerly, he raced in Sydney without any success. He did travel from Perth to Melbourne on many occasions, but I thought Sunline was a bit more versatile.
She had such a humble beginning when you, and so often is the case with wonderful horses, champion horses down through the years. She was by Desert Song from Songline, and by Desert Sun, I should say, and bred by Michael Martin and Susan Archer, and originally leased to the Connections, who raced the horse in Trevor McKee and Thane Green and Helen Lusty. The horse, I think, had won 6 races, and they had the option to purchase the filly at the time for $40,000 New Zealand. It's a pretty good deal.
Yes, that's right. That option was there. Trevor McKee snapped up that option as soon as possible, and they went on to race the horse until she retired.
And what a career she had. She started off at Pōroa on the 10th of May 1998, and she finished in the 4th of her Cox Plates when she actually ran 4th in the last of her 4 Cox Plates on the 24th of October 2002. But the journey between Pōroa and Moonee Valley was an extraordinary one. A man called Chris Johnson won the first 4 races on her. That she came to Sydney in September of 1998, and she's ridden by Larry Cassidy. And Larry had, I think, 6 wins on the mare.
Yes, it was actually Peter Johnson in New Zealand who rode her. When Trevor was bringing her to Australia, he wanted to use an Australian jockey, and he phoned. Actually, there's a story behind this. Trevor was going to use Jimmy Cassidy, and he looked in the calendar and seen the phone number there and rang who he thought was Jimmy Cassidy, and the phone was answered by Larry Cassidy. And Trevor said, Jimmy, how are you? Trevor, you've got Larry. Oh, you'll do. I'm bringing over a mare for the flight stakes. Could you ride her? Sure would, he said. And that's how history was made there with Larry. He got a lucky break.
Did he ever get a lucky break? You got on the filly when she was beaten in the Angus Amanesco actually at Caulfield in February 99. But then you jumped aboard in the CUNY the next start, and you won that. Then you won the race, was called the Moonee Valley Oaks. So two quick wins on her. And what did you feel then at the time with Sunlight? Did you know that she had that X factor?
She had that X factor. She was quite dominant when she raced in Sydney when Larry was riding her. And she came down, and as you said, Larry rode her in the Amanesco Stakes at Caulfield, where she was just a little bit disappointing, but that was her first up run, I think it was, if I remember. Larry was a stable rider for John Hawkes up in Sydney at the time. So Hawkes has required Larry for the next start, which was the CUNY Stakes at Flemington. Prior to this, I had rang Trevor to say, look, I see your mare's in here in Melbourne, and I'd like to put my name down if you're ever looking for a rider. And he said, Greg, I'll keep you in mind. I thought that'd be the last I'd hear of that. But Larry was committed to Hawkes' stable up in Sydney, and true to Trevor's word, he did bring me back and he offered me the ride on Sunline. And I had to think about it for a few minutes. Just joking. I jumped at the opportunity and rode her in the CUNY. Again, Larry was committed to Hawkes for the next start after that, which was the Moonee Valley Oaks.
Now, the Oaks at Moonee Valley was a $1 million race sponsored by Lone Star, and she absolutely cantered in and beat Grand Archway by 4.5 lengths.
That's right. She, I think that was her first start at Moonee Valley, and she just railed around that track like a greyhound. And Trevor always liked me to put the pressure on early because she had such a high cruising speed, and she was very dominant up front. It's always very hard for a horse to come from behind to beat her. So I'd take off a little bit early at Moonee Valley, and that's what the instructions were. And she careered away and won the Moonee Valley Oaks.
That was in March of 99 at Moonee Valley, as we mentioned. Then she went about two weeks later to Sydney for the Doncaster. Now, Larry Cassidy jumped back aboard. She had 52. Was that the reason you went on?
That's correct. Larry was still the regular rider. I was just filling in at the time when she was in Melbourne. So when she went back for the Doncaster, Larry rode her and won on her as a three-year-old. So Larry was back on board. She then went out for a spell after that race. When her new her preparation coming back, heading towards the Cox Plate, she first started up in Sydney for the heading towards the Epsom Handicap, and Larry was on board, and I don't think she won that preparation. She didn't win that preparation until she was coming down. She ran fourth in the Epsom Handicap.
That's right.
And then was Trevor rang me to say, Greg, would you like to ride Sunline in the Cox Plate? And naturally, I snapped up the ride and was more than happy to ride her. And from that point on, I never got off Sunline from that day forward.
It was an extraordinary partnership, and that Cox Plate had some outstanding gallopers. We had Tie the Knot and Sky Heights, and all the rage for memory was the three-year-old Redoute's Choice. Could he run the 2,000 metres? There was a chance he mightn't even run. There's all the hype and the drama that we know that the Cox Plate engenders in the week sort of coming up to that great race. But you guys just went about your business with her. Did she go to Breakfast with the Stars at all?
She did, Brian, and that was the key ingredient for her. She had done really well down here in Melbourne, but going to the Breakfast with the Stars on Tuesday, she did a terrific piece of work. Wasn't fast, but it was just in the manner the way she did it, workmanlike. And after that piece of track work, she went home and did well in the feed. And Trevor was really excited, got more confident going forward towards the Cox Plate on the Saturday.
And tell us about her and her manners, because we used to read and hear about She'd take a chunk out of Claire Bird, the strapper, who was a wonderful partner to the horse down through the years. And was she cantankerous? Was she nasty? What were the sort of the character? What was the character of Sunline?
Look, my job in the Sunline team was to ride her race day. A little bit of track work, but race day. So I was always on top of her, away from her antics from time to time. But it was Claire Bird who was heavily involved with Sunline's track work, riding, feeding, strapping, taking her for walks in the afternoon. So Claire got very close to Sunline, and they had this love-hate relationship going. But normally, you know, Sunline overall was a fairly kind horse, but at times she would get agitated. And, yeah, Claire does have some stories to tell about bits and pieces of her body getting bitten or pushed around a fair bit.
It was interesting to, over the years, watching her from my vantage point, when you'd be going out on the track, she always looked as though she was about to explode. She always looked really headstrong, even in the preliminary, even cantering down to the gate. She looked as though she was on the iron already, you know?
That's right. She was anxious.
Did she want to get on with it?
Yes, she did.
Yeah.
And Claire Bird suggested one day after my second or third ride on her that she was always, she likes to be close to the running rail, and she's more comfortable and settled going following the running rail. So she suggested I, in my prelim, go down close to the running rail. She might be more relaxed. And that's true. So from that day forward, I always got close to the running rail when I was doing my prelim, because coming out onto the track, she was bouncing and want reefing and wanted to go hard. But once I turned around to do the prelim, I'd head towards the running rail, and she went down a bit more placid.
And those horses, particularly those great horses, they seem so professional about their business, as though they know the saddle goes on, the parade happens, the fanfare and all the hype and all that, but then it gets down to showtime, game time.
Yeah, and you're right. She would walk around the parade quite relaxed, not too bad. I always kept my feet out of the irons longer, just so that she would be relaxed. Once you put your feet into the irons, the horses tend to get a little bit more edgy, knowing that they're going to be going fast soon. But, she was a true professional. When she got out onto the track, she wanted to get on with the job as quick as possible. She was a dominant horse, and that's why she was so good.
Okay, as we go for a break, and this is Your Racing Life, talking with the great former great rider from New Zealand, but certainly made Australia, and his mark in racing here in Australia, from New Zealand, in Greg Childs. And as we go for the break, this is the first of four Cox Plates that this great mare Sunline ran in, and this is Cox Plate 1999.
At the 700-metre mark, and Commands has run off the track. Commands has gone right to the outside. Sunline led by a length. Redouche Choice is under pressure second, and Sunline has increased the margin in front. She's gone 2.5 in front now from Redouche Choice. The New Zealand mare has raced away. She's 4 in front now from Redouche Choice, who can't bridge the gap. Sky Heights running on, followed by Intergaze, Tie the Knot, Testarossa, and make no mistake, but the bonny New Zealand mare is full of running around the turn. It's Sunline, 5 in front of Sky Heights. Tie the Knot with a withering run down the outside. Sunline 3 in front. Tie the Knot wearing her down. Sunline in front. Tie the Knot ducks in, and New Zealand takes the Cox Plate with Sunline. A length and 3/4, Tie the Knot. A length away, third, Sky Heights, then Testarossa, fourth.
My guest this morning, Greg Childs, talking about a wonderful career that spans and over 30 years in the saddle, 2,100 winners plus, 72 at Group 1 level. Where did it all start, and how did it start for you as a young man?
Well, we could go right back to when I was at Pony Club.
Yep.
My dad actually wanted to be a jockey when he was growing up. But back then in the 50s, it was frowned upon to be a jockey, and his parents wouldn't allow him to be a jockey. So he went on to be a barber. and then a fruiterer.
Yeah.
When the kids were born, he had a small 6 acres property, and we all had ponies and dogs and cats and et cetera. But I was the only one of the family that really took to riding horses, joined up with Pony Club. And my dad was actually pre-training racehorses for a trainer called Malcolm Smith, who trained a great horse called La Mer.
Oh, yes.
And so I was involved with horses and race horses all my life. And when I was 15, or actually when I was 12, I started going to the stable of Brian Deacon, who was a well-known educator of not only race horses but apprentice jockeys, similar to a Frank King here in Melbourne. And Brian Deacon produced top riders in Maurice Campbell, Jimmy Walker, Gary Phillips, Gary Stewart, the rider of Bone Crusher, and myself, and a few others. So going to Brian Deacon was my stepping stone into an apprentice jockey, which started when I was at the age of 16. And during my four-year term, I was 1 year I was leading apprentice rider in New Zealand.
When we talk to the Kiwis, particularly the jockeys and the great jockeys, Brent Thompson recently, Gary Willits, but Jim Cassidy, and the list goes on. There's still many that I want to talk to, like Shane Dye and people like that that have come across and made such a success of crossing the Tasman. They all seem to come up with the same thing. Oh, we're on a farm and we had 6 acres and we had a horse and we had cows. And you people all must have had a lot of land.
Yeah.
What is it? Because it doesn't have any
shared it.
No, you have shared it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, look, that's right. New Zealand's population is small, so, and there's a lot of land there, and that's just the upbringing from, you know, generations gone by with farming. Dairy farming is the predominant industry in New Zealand, and everyone has on a farm has a horse, or dogs, etc., and sheep. I was hesitant to say that. No jokes.
Barley.
So yeah, look, we're brought up around animals, and the transition there into horses is not a big step.
And was there always the plan, if you could make it in New Zealand and make a fist of your career there, were you always looking towards Australia?
Yeah, look, it was one step at a time. I just loved riding. It wasn't the money. It was enjoying riding winners, you know, climbing up the totem pole, see how far you can get in life. I was very fortunate. As I said, I was riding for Brian Deacon, who was well-respected for educating apprentice jockeys. A lot of other trainers would use his apprentices, and I was fortunate to ride a champion 2-year-old in my apprenticeship called Summer Hayes. She won 11 races as a 2-year-old, 3-year-old.
Got your first Group 1?
Yes, she did. I won my first Group 1 on her. And, you know, doors just kept opening. I was, after my apprenticeship, I was stable rider for Ray Verner, a champion trainer, leading trainer in New Zealand, brought horses over to Australia. My Good Man, winner of the Sydney Cup one time. I didn't ride it then, but I rode for Ray and had a lot of success. And then after 10 years of riding as a fully-fledged rider in 1990, Ray Verner was bringing a couple of horses over for the Melbourne Cup Carnival in 1990. I also, a couple of weight-for-age horses called Royal Creation and the Gentry. And I also had another horse called Mr. Brooker, who I rode and won on in New Zealand, was coming over for the Melbourne Cup. So I thought, well, coming over here, I'll try and see if these horses can springboard me into Melbourne racing. We'll give it 6 months' opportunity after the Cup to see how I would go and see if we could make Melbourne a go. And if not, I'd go back to New Zealand, where I was well known.
Mr. Brooker ran in the Melbourne Cup in 1990, the cup won by Kingston Rule in a track record time. But I remember that race, pardon me, you drew, I reckon, 22 of 24. And down the straight, by the time they got out of the straight, I reckon you were one off or on the fence.
Yes.
Did you take any with you?
No, I didn't get suspended. I was a very careful rider. I was a kind rider. Sometimes not.
Yeah.
He was an on-pace type of horse, so, that was the beauty about riding any horse. They can sort of get themselves out of trouble early and get into a position. That's what Mr. Brooker did, be positive, go forward. and we slotted into about fifth or sixth place going past the winning post.
You came to the attention of many trainers in Australia. Tommy Hughes was one, because I think your first Australian Group 1 came up in 1990, would have been the summer, in WA with a very good young horse called Umatilla in the Karrakatta Plate.
That's right. Riding track work at Flemington for Tommy Hughes. I was introduced to Tommy Hughes by a good friend of mine, Mark Broadford, who was an apprentice to Tommy Hughes. He was riding a bit of track work there. He said, come along, I'll introduce you to Tom. And I rode track work for Tom and other trainers. And I had a success during my time, during that time, in my first 3 months of Melbourne. And after the Melbourne Cup, riding Mr. Brooker third, Tommy then asked me to go over to ride Umatilla in the Karrakatta Plate during the Christmas period, and I went over there and we won on him.
And you must have come onto the radar of the great man Bart Cummings, because within the next year or so you're getting on some very, very good horses.
Well, look, nobody comes onto the radar unless you go out and sell yourself.
Yeah.
And we're all self-employed. Jockeys are self-employed. You've got to go out and promote yourself. And by doing that is starting riding track work. And my first venture into riding for Bart Cummings, even though I had some success as leading rider in New Zealand and some success here in Australia, I went to the foreman for Bart Cummings, at the assistant foreman. Leon Corstens was the foreman, yeah. But Leon had an assistant at the stables, tie-up stalls, and I went and said, look, can I ride track work? He says, look, I'd like to put you on, Greg, but you first might want to have to go out and ask Leon Corstens if I can put you on one before I send you out. And I had to go out to the middle to ask Leon if I could ride track work for you guys. And he said, of course, go back in there and jump on one. So the following year, for Bart Cummings, I was the stable rider.
Fantastic. Yeah, so. Yeah. And you were premier rider in Melbourne, is that right?
Yes.
91, 92?
That's right. As I said, the following year I was stable rider for Bart. Or probably not stable rider, but doing majority of his race riding.
Yeah.
And
because Stephen King was there with Let's Elope.
That's right.
Going into 92. So, and I suppose the lighter weights would have been young Stephen, but you were very prominent there, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right. I had a lot of success with Richfield Lady around the same time as Let's Elope and
Weekend Delight.
Yeah. So, you know, you've got to go out and make it happen yourself, and doors will open. And as I said, I rode a lot for Bart Cummings during 91, 92, and happened to be, and along with Tommy Hughes, at the end of that year, I was champion jockey in Victoria.
It's fantastic. Reva Diva won a blue diamond. For memory, didn't the bridle come loose, or didn't you have some steering problems with her?
Yeah. We did. Reva Diva was actually very fractious in the barrier, waiting for the other horses to be loaded, and the attendant who was helping me, actually, as she reared at one stage, trying to pull her back down onto the ground, he broke the bridle somehow. So she had to be backed out, and there was a replacement bridle that was put on, and it was way too loose. But that's all. It was up because they were 2-year-olds. The bridle was really suited for an older, bigger horse, and they had to use what they had, and going around that first turn at Caulfield in the Blue Diamond, the bit ran through her mouth because she was wanting to lay out, and I had to pull her quite firmly to come around the corner, and I pulled the bit through the mouth, and it was up the side cheek. So she had the reins as my steering as we balanced for home, and you just still got to go for it. And I threw everything at her, and she got up and won.
It was a good win too, trained by Bart. Greg, and continuing on, you formed a great association with an ex-Kiwi and Mike Moroney, and Second Coming was able to win the Derby, and those colours of Mike Moroney, the red, the blue and the black, were so prominent with G. Childs.
Yes, I had a good association with Mike in New Zealand when I was riding. I actually rode Mike Moroney's first winner. So I helped put him on the map, as I claim. And he went on. And, so when he came over and was based in Melbourne, I did a lot of riding for Mike at Flemington. And Second Coming was probably Mike's first major win in Australia, and it was a major win for me, winning the VRC Derby.
The 90s were good because, as I mentioned, you were the premier rider here in Victoria for 91, 92, 97, 98. You won the Scobie Breasley Medal in 1998, the Roy Higgins Excellent Award for Autumn in 97, and the Ronnie Hutchison Excellence Award for the Spring of 97. So you were getting these awards. You certainly were at the top of your game in the late 90s and then into the new millennium. And that's when Sunline, as we mentioned, came into your life. And that sort of took you further up the totem pole, as you say,
yeah,
where you can get on that champion horse.
Well, Brian, again, you know, it's all about being good at your job, having a good work ethic, nose to the grindstone, and just work through your way through life. And, yeah, I was very fortunate. 96, 97, 98 were great years for me, and then I was in a position, you know, with Larry Cassidy committed to ride Hawkses. I picked up the ride on Sunline, and yeah, she not only, as I tell people, not only lifted my profile, she lifted my bank balance, and life was good.
Yeah, well, in the new millennium, she started off in the Manicato in August, on the 19th of August at Moonee Valley. She won. She won the Memsie. She then went to the Fian. She won the Fian at Moonee Valley. She got beaten in the Turnbull by Fernway in a real slog to the line that was at Flemington, and that was her final race before she'd go to the Cox Plate, her second Cox Plate in 2000.
Yeah, look, that year she was really dominant. I mean, she won the sprint race, the Group 1 Manicato Stakes, 1,200 metres at Moonee Valley, and then was to come out and win the Cox Plate in the same year, over 2,000 metres. But that the race before the Cox Plate, yeah, she got beat by Fenway, Jack Denham's horse, Darren Beedman. Yeah, she was just caught wanting that last bit after her lead-up form, or win. She was just caught wanting that last bit, and she probably would have lost it on protest, Brian, because she was laying in quite bad, and I was bumping Fenway. He went on to win. I think we would have lost it on protest anyhow, but having that hard run just brought her cherry ripe for the Cox Plate.
It certainly did. It was the Cox Plate of the year 2000 on the 28th of October. And again, a good field. Diatribe had won the Caulfield Cup. He was there. Referral was down from Sydney. There's never been a bad field in the Cox Plate. She was 6-4 and to 11-8. We're going for a break. This is your racing life with Greg Charles. But have a listen to this. This is the most dominant win I think I've ever seen in a great race. It's the Cox Plate of 2000 and the mighty Sunline.
But this champion mare, Sunline, 500 to go. She's gone 4, 5, 6 in front. On the turn now from Scoozy Please, followed by Diatribe and Referral. But this is awesome. Back to back. It's all over for Sunline. Look at her go. Down the straight. 8 lengths in front of Referral and Diatribe. She might be the greatest in the world, Sunline. She streaks home in the Cox Plate. Canters home to the line to win by 6 lengths.
Greg Charles, our guest this morning on the first edition of the 2016 for This Is Your Racing Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Celebrating a great career with Greg Charles. Before the break, we heard that win. I think the caller said 6 lengths. You got it wrong. It was 7. Was that her greatest performance?
Oh, it was a great call. Yeah, she was so dominant. Yeah, that was probably her most dominant win. Was it her best race, her best win? I think the race in Hong Kong where she beat the local champ, Fairy King Prawn.
Oh, I was there that day. What a race that was.
Yeah, he was a red-hot favourite.
Stride for stride. Head and head up the straight, and the crowd around me were just going, Prawn, Prawn, Prawn. That's the locals were yelling for Prawn. But
that's right.
You weren't to be denied.
New Zealand, Sunline was, you know, had so many fans and so many followers because she was New Zealand-trained, dominant in Australia. She had a big fan base. She was racing up in Hong Kong. She was taking on the local champ, Fairy King Prawn, who was unbeaten. And it was just a great race. And it lived up to its high preparation and excitement with Sunline in her normal fashion leading. Fairy King Prawn, his normal fashion was to come from behind. And with 100 metres to go, Fairy King Prawn was coming out of the clouds. Sunline was starting to weaken, but she'd had a 3-length margin, And as the post was getting closer and closer, Sunline was weakening, Fairy King Prawn was coming hard.
Could you feel him coming?
Yeah, I could feel him coming. Uh-huh. I could sense him coming. And he was gradually getting to me. He was half a length, a neck, a head. And as we hit the line, we hit it together. I was stopping, but I thought I'd had my head down. I was hoping and thinking I might have just held on. Wasn't sure. Robbie Fraud, he yelled out, "I think I got you." And I thought, "Oh, I hope not." And the guy that interviews the riders on the way back in the red, he was at the 1,400 metre mark as we were pulling up, and he'd yelled out, "Sunline had got it," and relief, jubilation.
Amazing. Great race. There was controversy around that year.
Yeah, it didn't end there. It didn't end there.
Just through idle chat, is that right?
Yeah, it didn't end there. There was a celebration after the race, and we all went back to the hotel, and a lot of the media contingent, New Zealand, Australia, the owners of Sunline, and many other friends were there, and we were all celebrating in the bar. And yeah, a bit of idle talk from me about a passing comment that... a few races in Australia, we had a horse called Adam who took us on in the in a race, and Adam sort of was a horse that liked to go forward as well, and Adam and Sunline were going head for head, and we broke each other's heart in that race. So I'd mentioned to Justin Sheen, the rider of Adam in Hong Kong, who was in the mile, I said, "Look, I'm going to go forward and lead," and I basically, that's all that I was said. But the media got hold of what they believed, they thought I said, and blew it out in the paper, and all hell broke loose.
There's a guy from Sydney, I reckon, that wrote it, yeah.
Yeah, it was a reporter from Sydney who wrote a column after the race, and it was about the third or fourth paragraph down that he'd said that Greg Childs and Justin Sheen had spoken about how they were going to ride their horse in the race. And so there was... as I said, all hell broke loose because they deemed it, this jockey club in Hong Kong deemed it to be collusion and setting up the race to suit Sunline. But after a very public and aggressive stewards inquiry, the correct result came out that, yes, Greg Childs had told Justin Sheen what he was doing, but there was no law, no riding law, racing law had been broken. But I was fined $80,000 for bringing racing into disrepute for what the reporter had written.
Yeah, that was a pretty hefty fine. But the race was worth $1 million. That Hong Kong mile was worth $1 million Australian at the time. So you'd,
so at the end of the day, Brian...
It's cost you money?
Yeah, it cost me money, but I still had a little bit left to get a taxi home. may I say, that's still the world records fine from a fine for a jockey, $80,000.
Especially for a Kiwi, that would hurt.
My wife wasn't happy.
Oh, I bet. And across to Sha Tin, as we mentioned there in that mile, but then to Dubai in March of 2001. And again, Jim and Tonic and Fairy King Prawn were there to spoil the party for you.
Yes, that's correct. It was over 1,800 metres in Dubai. It was on the grass track. Sunline was in her usual front-running role, leading, but yeah, we wasn't to be. She put up a gallant effort, but ran third to Jim and Tonic and Fairy King Prawn.
And she continued to campaign right at the top of her game, winning in Australia, going back to New Zealand, winning at the highest level. And then Cox Plate number 3 came up in 2001, and the horse had been a nemesis for Sunline in this great horse, Northerly. But we'll talk about him in a moment because you were 6-for-6 with him. Tell us about that 2001 finish because it got very tight in the straight. Viscount was lucky to stand up in the middle, the three-year-old. You had Sunline on the inside, Northerly laying in, and it went to the stewards' room. It was high drama.
Yes, it was. And there's high stakes, so everyone's entitled to their thoughts. And, there was a... I'll just go back a step. Rounding the turn into the straight in the Cox Plate, Sunline was leading. She was at her top, entering the straight. And when horses get to their top, they start to they keep trying and trying and trying, but they tend to wander around a little bit. And Sunline just started to lay out slightly. Northerly was coming around out wider, and he had a bad tendency to lay in.
Yes, he did.
So, and then there was Viscount, the three-year-old of John Hawkes's, Kieran McAvoy riding, was poking up in between us. And with about 25 metres to go, it really got to the crunch with Northerly laying in and getting the advantage, Sunline weakening and laying out, and Viscount trying to come between us, got sandwiched, and we hit the line. Northerly first, Sunline second, Viscount third. And then Hawkes's and Kieran McAvoy went in to lodge a protest against Northerly and Sunline. Cut a long story short, placing stood, and I believe it was the right decision. Northerly was first, Sunline second, Viscount third. There was interference, but it was it couldn't be proven that Viscount was going to beat both of them or any of them, and I don't believe he would have either.
Yeah, I think that's a fair call. Watching and calling that race, I thought there was a fair few sort of contributing factors to it. High-level competitive riding, but it was beyond that. It was horses probably rolling about under pressure, right at top speed, like 150 metres, 200 metres from home. So I think most people at the end of the day thought placing should have stood.
Yeah, it was too close to the winning post. The margin was too great.
And that was Cox Plate number three. She bowed out after the Cox Plate at the end of a career of some, oh, how many starts did she have officially in the finish? 48. It was start number 48, and she ran fourth, and it was her swan song, fourth behind Northerly. How did you feel that particular day? Because there was the horse, you know, she'd given her all, and I remember her walking off the track, and I announced that she was leaving us for the last time. The crowd gave her a great ovation. Much sadness from you sitting above them. How close do you get to them?
Yeah, oh, for sure, you do get really close. She was a superstar. As I said, I had 22 rides on her. 32 rides for 22 wins, and 11 of those were at Group 1 level. She took me around the world, lifted my profile. My family involvement, you know, she was a New Zealand racehorse, my family in New Zealand, my wife and children here. She was just, you know, part of our family. She's plastered all over my wall. But that day, she, again, was in her normal pattern of racing, leading. It was all going to plan. Her lead-up form was really, you know, coming to hand really well. Around the turn, she couldn't quite get that break on them like she not likes to do. Northerly was tracking close to me, and I couldn't get away from him. And Northerly came over top of us, and so did a couple of others, and we weakened to finish fourth.
Yeah, she was beaten 2.4. She went out fighting. The run before, of course, in the Yolumba Group 1, she had a great battle with a champion horse in Lonro that particular day. So she was on song, but like all champions, it has to come to an end.
Yep.
But she was brave in bowing it, surely.
Yeah, she was. Yep, all good things come to an end, and Trevor didn't run her for the sake of it. She had a broodmare. She was going to be a broodmare in the future, and Trevor looked after her.
Northerly came into your life when you jumped on Northerly on the 17th of February 2001, and you won a Group 2, the Carline Cup at Caulfield. You didn't ride the horse next start in the Vic Cup, but you jumped on Northerly in the Australian Cup in March of 2001, and that's when he really came on the radar, I think, with all racegoers around Australia. We realised how great he was.
Yes, he came from Perth. Fred Kersley trained him. He came over here with a reputation. My manager, Dale Verhagen, looked after some jockeys in Perth and knew Fred, and asked Fred if we could get the ride. It was given to Brett Preble first time around, but Brett didn't get on well with Northerly. So when the opportunity came again, my manager, Dale, rang for the ride, and Fred put me on, and we won the Carline Cup, I rode him. I was sort of off and on. It wasn't a regular ride because at the same time I was riding Sunline.
Yeah.
They were clashing on a couple of occasions, So Sunline was always my first call.
And the spring of 2002 was a beauty. You won the Craigley on Northerly, you won the Underwood, you won the Turnbull, and then into the Caulfield Cup, and he had to carry 58 kilos, and you made that mid-race move. They were just dawdling along, but you took the race by the scruff of the neck.
Yeah, Fred was similar to Trevor McKee with Sunline. Northerly had a high cruising speed. He could sit back just probably a little bit further than Northerly, than Sunline. But again, Fred always liked you to take off a little bit early because they have such high cruising speed. Although Northerly never travelled that well, he just kept going and going and going. So he never travelled like a winner, but he just had that sustainability. So going past the 800 metre mark in the Caulfield Cup, we did start to let Northerly slide. Just wary that he had a big weight, and we had a couple of other nice horses with lighter weights coming through into the in that race in the Caulfield Cup, mainly one, Fields of Omar.
Yes.
Which you'd know quite a lot about, Brian.
So did you.
Yeah, yes. And knowing he had a light weight, and he was always in the back of my mind because his form, lead-up form, was very good in going into that. So I kicked clear around the turn in the Caulfield Cup with 58 kilos, and he kept giving, 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 but there was Fields of Omar coming out in the corner of my eye, but luckily Northerly was right on top of his game at that time and went on to win.
You gave Fields of Omar 4.5 kilos, so it was a terrific effort by Northerly. Just tell me this. You've got to tell me this, Greg. The margin was a half neck. If it had have gone another 50 metres, would Fields of Omar have beaten you?
Yeah, he was coming. Fields of Omar with a lighter weight definitely was coming. But I rode Northerly to win where the winning post was.
It doesn't help me.
Hey, look, no. Fields of Omar went on to be a champion in his own right.
Yeah, well, you're a part
two
of
two Cox plates.
Yeah, part of it for so much in the early part of his career. 6 for 6 on Northerly. We'll finish with the Caulfield Cup. It was such a great race. But after race riding, you retired in December of 2008. This business you've created is the Viper Jockey Safety Vest. Now, a lot of people wouldn't know much about that.
That's right, Brian. Before I retired, they introduced mandatory body protectors must be worn by all jockeys and track work riders, and it's throughout the world. But the vests that were on offer were a little bit rigid, not as comfortable. So I went about designing a vest, and after many prototypes, we came up with the vest called Viper, V-I-P-A, Velocity Impact Protection Apparel. And I've been distributing and selling that since 2007, and that's my job today. I distribute body protectors around the world. We've got about 8 countries around the world that we sell to, and so I'm still involved in the racing industry, having been retired in 2008. But still involved in the racing industry, but at a different level.
Now, are you the only vest that the jockeys are wearing, say, in Australia?
No. There's 3 other vests.
Okay.
There's RaceSafe and RideLight and Viper, and I'm probably in the middle, and I sell well, and I'm very proud and pleased that I contribute something back into horse racing in a safety product.
Well, that leads me now to the helmet, the jockey safety helmet. There's a lot of discussion at the moment, and the helmet that was the helmet that's been approved by the Australian Racing Board was to come in March of this year, 2016, but the jockeys haven't been happy with this new one.
No, they haven't, Brian, and my son is an apprentice jockey, and he's tried it on, and he says it's just so uncomfortable. It's like a mushroom sitting on top of your head. They probably haven't. The Racing Australian Board obviously want the jockey to be as safe as possible.
Sure.
When there's an accident happening.
Yep.
And because the head injury is the one that kills jockeys. And they have their heart in the right place, but they've probably just rushed it and put pressure on the manufacturer of the helmets to rush. So they've only got a couple of sizes out there, and yet jockeys probably need about 5 or 6 sizes because every head's a little bit different.
Sure.
And they're asking the jockeys to add padding to these two sizes or three sizes to make it more comfortable. And that's just not going to work. When you're in a professional field, you've got to have everything comfortable. And they are bigger and bulkier. So that they aren't going to get away from that, but they probably can make them more comfortable. And that's something they're working on now as we speak.
Why have they gone away from the one, the helmet that the jockeys have been wearing for probably the last 10, 12 years?
Yes, because when they hit the ground, there are many head injuries. And the thickness in the padding, it's called EPP, expanded polypropylene, is not thick enough. When they hit the ground at speed, it's doing the job that's okay. But
it could be better.
It could be better, yeah, and that's what the Australian Racing Board...
So that's what we're trying to get, that helmet that gives you more padding without being too heavy and sort of wobbling on your head type of thing.
That's right. Probably it's a little bit heavier because it's thicker, and the way it's designed at the moment, it is wobbling on your head, so they need to redesign it. But it is thicker, it is a little bit heavier. But that's the price. I mean, that's the catch. You know, the price you pay for more protection.
No doubt.
Is that it's got to be a bit thicker, therefore it's a bit heavier. So there's a little bit more work to go.
Mm. You're proud of your son, Jordan. He's doing well. He's tall. Yeah. How long can he stay in the game?
Well, you can stay in the game for as long as you like, as long as you're dedicated. It's all about weight related. And he's riding within a weight range. He rides around 54.5 kilos. And he's got to watch, because he's so tall, when he gets suspended or an injury, that's when he really has to watch it, because if he doesn't, he'll fill out and you'll get past a point where there's no return. He knows that. He's living his dream. He's always wanted to be a jockey.
Did you ever want to stop him?
No. No, because racing was good to me.
Yes.
It's like anybody in life. You know, if something's good to you, you push or you angle your kids into that direction.
Fair call, yeah.
And racing was good to me. It's a high-risk industry. Accidents do happen.
He had a bad one at Hamilton?
Yes, he's had two nasty falls, and he's broken his wrists twice. So every fall he's had, he's put his hands out to break the fall, and he's broken his wrists. And he's done that twice. But he's had a few other falls where he's been fine. But we know, all jockeys know the risks, accept those risks, and try to ride and be careful.
When they go out to ride and you're watching it at home and you can watch every ride he has, whether it be Melbourne, he does a lot of riding in Sydney, how do you feel about that?
Nervous.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm terrible. Because I know what can go wrong. I'm watching and I'm thinking, no, Jordan, you've either got to get in the gap or get out the gap. You don't sort
There's
of,
no in between.
There's no in between because the horse on the outside can just drop in and you clip heels and you fall. That's the worst thing because I know what can happen. So, you know, I'm always talking to him on the TV, you know, go now or not yet or you know, this and that. But overall, he's doing really well. He's apprenticed to Patrick Payne. He's been great to him.
Yeah, good horseman.
Yeah, good horseman. The whole Payne family, as we know.
Yes.
So he's progressing and doing really well.
Good to chat with you, Greg. Thanks for your time popping in this morning on this Saturday morning. Have a great year. Good luck with the Vipers and what you're doing. And I've got to say, in all the time that I've known you, you've always been a wonderful ambassador for the sport, and you should be very proud of what you've achieved.
Thanks, Brian. Look, racing has been good to me throughout my life, and I'm just more than happy to try and put back in what I can and be accommodating to everybody.
True gentleman, one of the greats of Australian racing. Our guest this morning, Greg Charles.
Northerly down to the 200. Charles pulled the whip. He's the leader from Freemason. Fields of Omar's coming down the outside, and then came Republic Lass. Northerly in front with 100 metres to go. Fields of Omar, Republic Lass are closing. Northerly in front. Fields of Omar tries hard. Northerly, Northerly! Northerly beats Fields of Omar. Cup.